now, the man behind the voice you've been hearing for decades associated with Valley sports teams. It's time for That's So Money with Arizona Diamondbacks and ASU broadcaster Jeff Munn.
Well, hi, and thanks for checking in again with our podcast, That's So Money, here on sports360az.com, where this morning, and I'm taping this on Friday, January the 10th, I enjoyed listening to Brad Sesmant and his interview with Ray Anderson. And remember, anytime that you miss the show, you can always check out podcast of Brad's show right on this very website, just like you're checking out this podcast. I got a couple of things that we can do here on this week's edition. I have been meaning to give you a history lesson, and I'm going to save that for the back end of today's podcast. But I want to start first with something that's fresh on the minds of a lot of people, and it's the Baseball Hall of Fame voting. And I want to take this from the perspective and a little bit of background. For those who are not aware, I've been involved with the Arizona Diamondbacks since their inception in 1998. I've been a broadcaster with the club since 2001, a full-time broadcaster since 2006. Okay, enough of the background. More so than who was voted in this week, there's been a lot of talk about how the vote is conducted and who should be doing the voting. So I guess I'm going to jump in with both feet into that debate. I am particularly uncomfortable with those who are in the Baseball Writers Association of America who don't cover the sport on a regular basis today, having Hall of Fame votes. Now, you could make the argument that the writers who don't cover the sport on a regular basis now were at the time that a lot of the players who are on the ballot were playing. Okay, I see that argument. But when you say you are a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America, there's an immediate perception in a lot of people's minds that you cover the sport on a regular basis today. And a number of people who have those Hall of Fame ballots don't do so. One of them is here in town, Mark Fowler, the editor of the sports editor of the Arizona Republic. I've never met Mark, and I don't mean this to be a criticism of him personally. I've never met the man, and I'm not able to judge his work as a sports editor. So please, if Mark gets word of this, this is not meant to be a personal criticism of Mark Fowler. But Mark Fowler, because of the fact that he has management duties with the paper, doesn't get to a lot of D-backs games in person. And I'd have to say maybe out of 81 home games last year, we maybe saw him at 20 or so. To me, this is just my opinion, that does not qualify him to have a vote for the Baseball Hall of Fame. He is a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America, and that's fine. I have no issue with that. But to me, if you're going to vote on the Hall of Fame, you should be covering the sport on a regular basis in the here and now. Because really, to judge accurately the resumes of Hall of Fame players, in a lot of cases, it's best to judge them against the current players. That's not the only way that you judge the merits of a player for induction into the Hall of Fame, but it's a really good way to do so. Mark Fowler last year, and he wrote this in an article in the paper, submitted a blank ballot as a protest to players who were believed to be taking steroids. And we all know who those players are, and I'm not going to go through the list here. And a lot of people took exception with what Mark Fowler did because they saw it as an attempt to just gain Mark some publicity, the look at me ballot. Dan Lebatard of the Miami Herald and ESPN is going through the same thing right now. A lot of people are getting all over him about selling his vote to the website Deadspin. Okay, first of all, yeah, what Lebatard did was wrong. He should have been stripped of his ballot. I also read today that he's been banned from using his Baseball Writers Association card to gain entry into press boxes, although he can certainly apply for individual game credentials from major league teams. What Dan Lebatard did was wrong. If Mark Fowler is given a ballot, fine. He can go ahead and submit a ballot, and I don't have a problem with that. But this whole thing about who is qualified to vote on the Hall of Fame really needs to be examined. I am a broadcaster, And I'm not about to say that all broadcasters should have a vote for the Hall of Fame. I'm nowhere near qualified to vote on the Hall of Fame for a variety of reasons. I've been a baseball broadcaster full-time for only 8 years, going into my ninth, and most years, up to half the games the D-backs play, I watch on television because, for those who are not aware, and this is not a state secret, a lot of times when the club is on the road, I do the pre- and post-game shows from here at our radio station. So I don't think watching a game on television is a proper way to gauge the impact a player has either. But I think about broadcasters like Vin Scully, the gentleman who's going into the hall this year is the Ford C. Frick Award winner, Eric Nadell, and other longtime broadcasters, John Miller, Dwayne Kuiper, who both played and now broadcast Major League Baseball. They have no vote for the Hall of Fame. But certainly they're worthy of making those decisions because, just like the writers, they've watched a great deal of Major League Baseball over the years and saw a lot of those players play. And I really would like to see Major League Baseball kind of take back the voting process away from the baseball writers. Not because baseball writers aren't good people. They're terrific people, and I learn a great deal both from reading and talking to baseball writers. But it's clear that not everybody in that group is approaching filling out a ballot the right way. Ken Gernick, a guy I really admire, who writes for Dodgers.com and was writing about baseball long before he joined MLB.com as a writer, said he was not going to vote for anybody who played during the steroid era. And a lot of people are criticizing him for that. And I don't have a problem with that necessarily. If he's not comfortable doing that, then he shouldn't vote for him. But I think this notion that somebody who does not cover the sport on a regular basis now might have years ago, or somebody who broadcasts the sport on a regular basis but doesn't have a ballot, that tells you right there this process is flawed and it needs to be changed. And I want to say again for the record, I have never met Mark Fowler. I subscribe to The Republic, so I read his sports section every day. I have no personal problem with the man. And please, if this gets back to Mark, that I'm being critical of him. No, I'm not. And I want that on the record. This is not a personal criticism of Mark. Again, I'm not a print journalist, so it'd be far from me to judge what he does as a sports editor or as a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America. Okay, now on to the history lesson. As football starts to wind down and the college football season has ended, by the way, that Fiesta Bowl, what'd I tell you? Turned out to be pretty good, didn't it? You see, a lot of times those games you don't expect to be gems turn out to be gems, and it was a great game. Anyway, as football starts to wind down, and we're just down to the pros now as opposed to the colleges, college basketball starts to take more of a front and center portion of the spotlight in the sporting consciousness. Just last night, Arizona played at UCLA, beat the Bruins. Arizona State won at USC. In fact, all four of the state's Division I programs won. Grand Canyon won, so did NAU. College basketball has always been a fascinating thing to a lot of people, especially in Tempe, from this standpoint. A lot of people have been puzzled for a long time as to why Arizona State has not been a more dominant force in college basketball. The reason being that, the thinking being that Arizona State, like a lot of other people have surmised, is a quote-unquote sleeping giant. You know, they've always said that about ASU just as an athletic program in general, and somewhere down the road we'll talk about that in relation to the appointment of Ray Anderson as the new VP of University Athletics. And here's a little something to think of in terms of college basketball. Arizona State hasn't always struggled to gain national attention in college basketball. Back in the 1980-81 season, and this was a couple of years before CBS got involved with the NCAA and turned the tournament into the March Madness that we know today. But in 1980-81, Arizona State not only was a top five team in the country, they featured a starting lineup that included four legitimate NBA players, including a backcourt of Byron Scott and Fat Lever, Alton Lister, Kurt Nymphius, Sam Williams, Johnny Nash, on and on it went. It was coached, of course, by the late Ned Wolk, and their last regular season game was a dismantling of the highest order of the top-ranked team in the country, Oregon State and Corvallis. In fact, if you talk to ASU historians, that Saturday afternoon in Corvallis is generally considered by a lot of people to be as close to a perfect game played by an ASU team, at least certainly in men's basketball, and maybe overall. Maybe ASU's win over Nebraska in football in 1996 is in that same category. But the win that that 80-81 team had in Corvallis was a thorough behind-whipping of Oregon State from start to finish. Yes, they did lose in the first round of the NCAA tournament, and there's no getting around that. But here's what's interesting about that year. Most of the crowds that attended games at Wells Fargo Arena, was then known as the University Activity Center, were in about the same vicinity in terms of size as the crowds that Herb Sendek's teams have attracted since Herb arrived in 2007. So I guess the point I'm making is this. It's never been a huge college basketball area in Tempe. Here's another little thing that you may not be aware of, especially if you just moved here recently. The year after that, the Devils slumped to a losing record. Byron Scott sat out the year because of a tiff between two of Ned Wolk's assistant coaches that never really got solved. And as a result, a university administrator decided he had had enough. And Ned was very unceremoniously removed as the head basketball coach. In the time that they were searching for a new coach, they flew in a well-known head coach from the Midwest for a weekend to try to convince him to leave the cold climes where he was and come back to the West where he had been before and take over at ASU. That coach came in for a weekend, looked over things, got on the plane, that's my dog in the background, by the way, got on the plane and went back to Iowa City. That coach was the head coach at the University of Iowa. His name was Lute Olson. ASU ended up hiring Bob Weinhauer from Penn because the main thing on Bob Weinhauer's resume was he had taken Penn to a Final Four in 1979. That was the famous Larry Bird Magic Johnson Final Four. And Penn lost in the semifinals to Michigan State. So you know the story from there if you followed ASU basketball for any length of time. A year later, Ben Lindsay is removed after one season as the head coach at Arizona. Ben, who had been a very, very successful coach at Grand Canyon when it was an NAIA school, and at his press conference, he uttered the famous quote, "If you can drive a Ford, you can drive a Cadillac," when talking about his ability to coach a Division I program. Well, that lasted 1 year, and Lute Olson took over from there. And it didn't take Lute long to get Arizona into the national spotlight. And it's been pretty much in the national spotlight ever since. Here's another interesting thing about that 1 year that Ben Lindsay was the coach. You know that anytime they open the doors at McHale, it seems like they fill the place. That particular season that Ben Lindsay was the coach, you could have shot a cannon through McHale Center and not hit anybody. I remember one night I was just driving somewhere and I was listening to the U of A, the radio broadcast, and a great guy that I knew for many, many years named Pete Solomon was the play-by-play announcer. And it was literally so quiet you could hear a pin drop. Now, granted, that's 30 years ago, and a lot of games have been played since that time. But I think when you start to judge Herb Sendek, I think it's really unfair to look at Herb and say, well, they're not drawing crowds. They're not getting, you know, a lot of national attention. They're not doing this. They're not doing that. This has never been a great college basketball hotbed, Phoenix, Arizona, or Tempe. Yes, it has been for the pros, and we've talked about this before. The love of the Suns is in large part to the fact that they were the first major league franchise to arrive in Phoenix, and they had their roots in Phoenix, and they did win right away. Second year of the franchise, they made the playoffs, and they've been a consistent performer. You just, you know, look at their winning percentage since they entered the NBA. But in terms of the college game, it's just never really taken off very well at ASU. I've always contended that ASU, if you say, is it a football school, is it a that school, is it a this school, Arizona State's a football school, and to a lesser extent, it's a baseball school because of all the success that ASU baseball has had over the years. Five national championships, and while they haven't won one since 1981, Arizona State baseball is consistently a postseason performer and in the discussion for a trip to the College World Series, as I'm certain they will be this year. I have great respect for Herb Sendek, and you hear people all the time in the college basketball world talk about the fact that whenever Herb Sendek's in the room, he is the smartest guy in the room. And I think it would be a mistake at this point to judge Herb harshly, and especially if you're going to tie his resume to whatever goes on at the box office. This is a tough place to get college basketball players to come and play basketball. He got Jahee Carson. Carson's made no secret of it. He's leaving after this year. But it's very difficult to sustain success at Arizona State. Part of the reason Lute Olson wasn't interested in Arizona State, and he talked about this in his book a few years ago, was the fact that he just sensed that there was not a level of commitment for men's basketball in Tempe. Arizona State, despite its large enrollment, does not have the deep-pocketed boosters that a lot of schools have. You've heard the reaction of boosters at Texas to the hiring of Charlie Strong. There's a lot of deep-pocketed boosters at Texas. Oklahoma State is T. Boone Pickens. Oregon is Phil Knight. Arizona has Artie Moreno, the owner of the Angels. There have been a number of occasions that Artie Moreno has been called on to write a check to buy off a football coach and get him out of town. And there just aren't those kind of donors connected to Arizona State. Craig Weatherup is a major investor in a couple of companies, and he was the main financial force behind building ASU's basketball practice facility, which, if you haven't seen it, is on a par with just about any practice facility in the country. And it was a stipulation of Herb Sendek's when he came to Tempe. He said, I've got to have a practice facility. And so they built one for both the men's and the women's program, and they are unrivaled around the country by a lot of schools. But there just isn't that deep-pocketed investor that ASU can lean on consistently to provide an unlimited amount of resources. And we don't have the time in this podcast to go into why that's the situation ASU finds itself in. But that is the situation they find themselves in. And I think, as I said, it would be unwise to try to judge what Herb Sendek's doing in Tempe to what a Mike Krzyzewski does at Duke or even a Sean Miller does at Arizona. Arizona is a basketball school. They are much more interested in basketball at the U of A than they are in football. And it's borne out in the fact that the football program, which has never been to a Rose Bowl, never appeared in a BCS game in the BCS era, and I know Arizona State didn't in the BCS era either, but Arizona's never been to the Rose Bowl, and yet, by and large, the fans down there are kind of okay with it because they've always had basketball. If you think about why U of A changed football coaches, Dick Tomey was basically run out because he wasn't able to follow up the success. Does this line sound familiar? Of the year they went to the Holiday Bowl and beat Nebraska. John Makovic, you probably know the story there. It was just a disaster from the word go in terms of his relationship with players. Mike Stoops was very hard for Mike Stoops to, number one, say the right thing at the right time or control his demeanor on the sidelines. And he was causing divisions within his own program toward the end of his tenure there. Terrific assistant coach. But for the most part, Arizona football is essentially what ASU basketball is. A program that once in a while is going to do something really strong on the national level, but has a hard time sustaining it because of a lack of support and a lack of really deep-pocketed boosters to keep it rolling. The U of A does have Artie Moreno, but the Devils just don't have that deep-pocketed booster that can just solve any problem with the writing of a check. It takes a lot of people with a lot of checks to get it done, and that's tough. So as we go through this college basketball season, try to keep that in mind. They have a terrific coach in Herb Sendek, and I give Herb credit. He's adjusted what he does philosophically in terms of basketball to fit the personnel he has. You remember when he got here? It was very much a deliberate offense in the matchup zone, and they're not doing a lot of either one right now because Jahi Carson wants to run, and Herb tailored his offense and his defense to the strengths of his players. That not a lot of coaches can do that or would be willing to do that, but Herb does it, and he's made it work. I know it gets frustrating that you'd like to have a team that won 20 to 25 games consistently and beat the U of A more times than not, but remember, this is not a football school. Anyway, I've probably gone longer than I should have on this week's podcast, so I'm going to stop right here. Next time we visit with you, more thoughts just off the top of my head, which gets thinner by the day. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to visit around this website. Look at all the great content, breaking sports news, podcast interviews, all kinds of great stuff. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll talk to you soon.